This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A little later in the show, we'll be taking a look at a new exhibit opening at the Freedom Center. It profiles African-American men who have changed the history of this country. But first, 20,000 Chinese men were recruited to the United States to help complete the Transcontinental Railroad. Not many years later, the U.S. put a ban on Chinese immigration. The Chinese role in completing one of America's great 19th century achievements is often overlooked in history, but a new exhibit at the Public Library of Cincinnati in Hamilton County downtown hopes to change that. Roland Chu is the Director of Research for the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America Project at Stanford University. He joins us on the phone. Roland, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Felicity Tao is the chair of the Greater Cincinnati Chinese Cultural Exchange Association. She's in the studio with me. Hi, Felicity.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So this exhibit is coming to town, Felicity, because of some encounters that you've had. And I'd like you to just give us some background on the origin of this.
I met with Monica Arima at a rally to support Sherry Chan. She had a case in the Cincinnati courthouse 2 years ago, and I met her, and she was talking about this project. She was involved, and she wondered if any of us was interested in bringing the exhibits to Cincinnati. And I learned something about the exhibits, and my husband was a history major, so we were very interested in the project, and that started the conversation.
And Roland, at Stanford University, this research originated. Tell us what you all did. There was 7 years spent looking into this?
That's right. Our project on the Chinese railroad workers in North America began in 2012. I joined in 2015 as the director of research. And we're not the first to look at the phenomenon of Chinese migrant labor who came in the 19th century to build this transcontinental railroad. But our project is the one that has established really the publications of record based on primary material.
What did you find that wasn't previously known?
I would say there's multiple stories, but there's one insight that hasn't been previously fully explored, that is the entrepreneurial spirit of these migrant laborers. The prevailing narrative before our publication has been more of almost a victim's narrative. They certainly did suffer harsh conditions anytime someone relocates from a homeland to another unknown region to do this kind of work. It's a tremendous hardship, but we also found evidence of, real entrepreneurial acumen in taking advantage of the employment opportunity and the dire straits that the business was in when they turned to hiring Chinese to do the work.
I read in a report about this in which you were interviewed that was something that you had said previously, and you noted in this report that maybe some Americans had feared that the migrants would take away their jobs or imperil their culture. And so when a lot of these Chinese immigrants went back to their villages, they were able to change those parts of their world through architecture with their stories of the global world, you said. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so it's really two things you're bringing up of real note. And the first is the reception to Chinese in North America. In the 19th century, the evidence we find, the press coverage, the legal cases, the acts of retaliation or pushback and violence are eerily similar to today. The rhetoric of stealing our jobs, diluting our culture, an invasion, mass influx, this kind of language was prevalent at the time and is quite consistent with today. The other story you mentioned is the impact they had. Most of the Chinese who came for this work fully intended to return home. This was not a notion of relocating to change the North America, but to flee abject poverty in most cases and political violence, come to North America to answer a call for work, bring back their wages, and in fact had a significant impact on their home villages, as you say, from architecture as well as popular culture, and really globalized, at least across the Pacific Ocean, our two worlds.
Building a transcontinental railroad that would be the first in the world seems like no easy task. Seems like some pretty hard labor, Roland. And I'm wondering, what was it that these Chinese men saw appealing about the opportunity?
Well, we have to be honest that it was the potential for earnings. They did not have the opportunity to earn this kind of wages in their homeland. Many of the Chinese who came to build the railroad were following the footsteps of previous Chinese who came for the gold rush. So the whole west coast of the North American as well as South American continent was known for the discovery of gold in the mid-19th century. Word spread quickly, and there were large numbers of Chinese who came for that. They were already here when more Chinese were recruited by the company that was building the railroad, Chinese who came to build this railroad. It was understood that this would be very hard work. I don't think anyone realized how hard until they got into it, especially in the upper elevations of the Sierra Nevada mountains.
Felicity, we heard Roland say there earlier that some of the experiences of the Chinese immigrants at that time are similar to feelings now. And that seems similar to what you noted in a blog that you wrote for the Library of Cincinnati and Hamilton County, in which you detailed your journey to claim American citizenship after coming here from China for school. And I'm wondering if you can expand upon that.
Sure. As I said, there's always this deep sorrow among the Chinese community that no matter how hard we try, we remain permanent aliens because of our appearance and a cultural heritage. Many of us experienced racism and were told to go back to our country. This happened to me, who came to this country 20 years ago, to presidential candidate Andrew Yang, who was born and raised here. So last year, my husband and I celebrated our 20th anniversary in San Francisco, the first city we set our feet on in this country. We were walking in the street, looking for a hotel around Union Square, when someone kicked my suitcase, called nasty names, and told us to go back to country, to go back to our country. So it happens just way too frequently to way too many Asian Americans.
Why do you think that is?
It's bigotry. It's racism. It's the notion that no matter how hard a person who looks different from you can never be assimilated into the mainstream society.
Roland, American history is fraught with racism, and primarily against African Americans, certainly across our history. And today we have a lot of anti-Hispanic immigration sentiment that's permeating our discourse. What do we not understand about racism towards Asian populations that have immigrated to this country?
I think it's a good question, and as Felicity was saying, there are multiple factors that go into what we could call a nativist backlash to immigrants, and especially regarding Asian immigrants who, of course, now come to North America from multiple origins in East Asia as well as the subcontinent of Southeast Asia. One thing that our historical work brings out is that change is very hard to internalize for a resident population. And the change in this case is the prevailing notion of difference between long-term Caucasian population and more recent Asian immigrants. In the case of the Chinese railroad workers, there was a prevailing notion that Caucasians were more experienced, were more physically capable of doing the work, as well as more intelligent to perform what is often a complex task. And when, in fact, the company staged competition between those population was known to be the best excavation workers, in this case from Wales, and against a Chinese workforce, they were shocked to find that the Chinese workforce could outperform them. And it was a very difficult outcome for anyone to accept, even with the actual evidence.
Shortly after the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869, 6 years later, 1875, the United States adopted the Page Act, banning Chinese women from coming to this country. And then 7 years after that, in 1882, there was a prohibition of all immigration of Chinese laborers. And this was after this very significant contribution to a very significant project, Roland. What motivated that passage and those laws, and what impact did it have?
Yeah, that's what we were referring to. The motivation behind the passage of these restrictions and exclusion laws is, in fact, the realization that the prevailing notion of superiority was not based on any evidence, not based on any fact, and that immigrant labor, be they Chinese or from anywhere else, in fact, from populations in Western Europe who were thought to be inferior to other populations, that they were all capable of doing the same work, in fact, were perhaps more motivated to do the work that was not glamorous but needed to be done. And in fact, the Chinese contribution to this railroad construction was to unify or help unify a country that was split by the fratricidal civil war. So this is an unnerving realization of the contribution. It was more than physical. It was also social. And it was at a time when there were economic downturns, and we have a history, not unlike other societies, of looking at those who have least power to blame them for our insecurities.
U.S.-China relations are a very important international topic these days. What were U.S.-China relations like in this period?
The United States, in brief, the members of the federal government were actually quite interested in the worlds across the Pacific, as they call them, the Celestial Empire. There was certainly a lot of stereotyped notions of who they would find there, but we had diplomatic missions going to China. We had lots of interest in trade and in labor exchange. So there was not the kind of, you could say, scare tactics that we see towards the end of the 19th century and certainly in the 20th century.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking today about a traveling exhibit honoring Chinese railroad workers. It's called Chinese Railroad Workers Photography Exhibit. It's on display at the Downtown Main Library through August 31st. My guests are Roland Chu. He's the Director of Research for the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America Project at Stanford University. He's on the phone with us. And Felicity Tao. She's the chair of the Greater Cincinnati Chinese Cultural Exchange Association, and she's with me in the studio. Roland, tell us what day-to-day life was like for these Chinese migrants while they were working on the Transcontinental Railroad project.
Day-to-day life was tough. The length of the construction project meant that no one could return back to something like a home base at the end of the day. As the railroad line was being built over the 9,000-foot summit of the Sierra Nevada to get from Sacramento to the Plain States, the work camps had to be moved progressively along the line. Caucasian or white workers were most often housed in railroad cars with the relative comfort of, four walls, a working stove, cooks. The Chinese were housed in tent camps. We have some historical photos. They would also form their own community. They did not circulate with the whites in the after hours. Day-to-day work was extremely arduous. It's a physical demand that they couldn't use hydraulics today, modern such. The only aid that they had in their work besides their own two hands was a relatively uncontrollable black powder dynamite, nitroglycerin. So they did use some explosives, but that not only blew up rock, but also people.
Do we have any evidence of how these Chinese workers felt about that inequity between them and the white workers on this project?
Well, we have a dramatic piece of evidence. It's a wonderful question. We have one of the stories of one of the earliest and largest labor mass action movements. The Chinese workers went on strike in 1866 at the time when they knew that the owners, the big four, Stanford, Hopkins, Huntington, and Crocker, who were owned the company and building the railroad, were most desperate to meet a deadline set by U.S. Congress so that they didn't have to pay back the large grants and, in fact, could earn a bonus, and were most desperate for an increased number of workers. And as the Chinese found a way to communicate across the line from where they were in dispersed camps, their grievance about being paid less than half the daily wage of white workers, they staged a mass walkout. It lasted for a number of days. The prevailing story is that they were starved out and forced back to work because, in fact, Crocker refused to provide food. But we also know that in the subsequent days after they did go back to work, the pay was slowly raised and they were given some accommodation.
Wow, that's fascinating. We don't know a whole lot about the individuals, though, do we?
We have, unfortunately, no primary voice from a Chinese railroad worker from the time that they were working. No diary, no memoir, no letter. We do know that a number of them were literate because of their signatures on payroll records that convey a degree of literacy that could have included writing letters. We speculate that for the reasons of these are fragile documents, paper at the time, as well as a different sense of what they would communicate. That is, what was most important was to send back funds to their families. They didn't prioritize sending back their sentiments.
Felicity, as someone who is a native of China and moved to this country, I'm curious about whether you knew about these events before you arrived here. Is it something that's taught in China?
I heard very briefly about the history from friends and literature we read, but I don't think it was formally taught in school. And after I came over here, as I said, my husband was an Asian American history major at University of Cincinnati. So I kind of read a lot of materials he read, and we are both very interested in history and so on. So we talked extensively about that, and I started having a fuller picture of Chinese American history in this country. And I always kind of viewed it as someone else's history because I thought we have made lots and lots of progress since the railroad workers' time. And I really didn't feel personally connected to this part of history in the beginning until I experienced racism myself. I experienced some of the prejudice that was experienced by the railroad workers. Exactly. That's how I felt the direct connection to these railroad workers. And I thought, this is really part of my history and my children's history and this country's collective memory and history.
Why do you think this exhibit at the library is important for people who look like me?
I think we are all together in the same boat. The United States is our country. We are fellow citizens. And I think it's important for all of us to learn each other's history. I want our history to be remembered and told as your history. And I'm hoping that we learn lessons, draw valuable lessons, and celebrate our accomplishments as one people. So I think it's important that we all are exposed to this type of exhibit. And also, I think it gives a voice to today's Chinese American community who continues to contribute significantly to this country's economy and everything, but continues to struggle as equal citizens.
And Roland, let me ask you the same question. You and your team spent 7 years on this, researching this period in American history and the Chinese contribution to it. Why was that so important?
Well, I think as Felicity says, it is an American story. It's a story, of course. The individuals are from China. They performed work that no one was either willing or perhaps even capable of accomplishing. But it is truly filling out the story of the American resurgence, really the recovery after the Civil War, during and after the Civil War. And for us to understand what makes for healing in our society is to understand both the role of communications to meet each other across this vast continent at a time that was really not possible in popular imagination, as well as who enables. And it took, of course, the business savvy of some entrepreneurial large business concerns, very wealthy individuals to build this company. But it also took the labor of those 15 to 20,000 Chinese who represented, towards the end of the construction, almost 90% of the workforce to accomplish this feat. It really gives a new picture of the contribution of immigrants to the cohesion of our American society.
Roland, you're based at Stanford University, and that's one of our country's most esteemed institutions. And it's named for Leland Stanford, who is one of the Big Four. I believe you mentioned the Big Four earlier in the context of the labor dispute. Leland Stanford, Collis Huntington, Mark Hopkins, and Charles Crocker. These were the guys behind this transcontinental railroad project. Do people look back now poorly on Leland Stanford's legacy because of this, or is he still viewed more positively?
But we hope that we enrich and deepen the picture of Stanford. He was responsible for employing a number of the Chinese, in fact, not only on the railroad, but on his personal property, as well as the infrastructure, the gardening and the building of Stanford University. Apparently, he had members of the Chinese community in his own home. He also, though, when he was running his political campaigns for governor, he was even nominated, or there was a campaign to make him run for president, issued statements that were very consistent with the anti-Chinese rhetoric of the time. So it's a complex story, and as historians, we find that most fascinating and helpful to distribute.
Felicity, I want to read a piece from that blog we referenced earlier that you wrote for the library's website. Quote, "My son Teddy, who rides with me each morning for his summer internship downtown, was in the car with earbuds on when I heard the Golden Spike Festival story on NPR. I burst into silent tears when I heard one of the Chinese railroad workers' descendants say, quote, Chinese were the perpetual foreigner, and we are still the perpetual foreigner. I didn't want Teddy to hear this. If he heard this, I would tell him this was not true. America is his home, his homeland. He can grow roots here and have equal opportunities to thrive. Every nation and every people have their struggles, and this is one of ours. We don't have an option but to work hard to make it a little easier for future generations." What kind of conversations about your race do you have with your son, Teddy?
I actually haven't had the conversation with him yet. I assume that he didn't hear that. But we are a very socially active family. And Teddy's actually very interested in getting involved in the democratic process as a career. So I think this type of discussion is pretty common at our household. And I think our family owns the responsibility as citizens to contribute to the society from all aspects as much as we can. So we all struggle. You know, this is one of our struggles, and we take ownership of it. And I'm hoping that we have allies and we will make it a little bit easier for future generation. I really have tremendous respect and hope in my son's generation, you know, seeing him and his friends growing into responsible citizens, getting involved in, you know, social and political affairs. That's very encouraging to me.
The Chinese Railroad Workers Photography Exhibit is on display at the Downtown Main Library through August 31st. My guests today have been Felicity Tao. She's the chair of the Greater Cincinnati Chinese Cultural Exchange Association, and Roland Xu, the director of research for the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America Project at Stanford University. Thanks to both of you for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
You've You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.